Outdoors coming on the airwaves, coming your way.
Hey now, we're outside indoors, beat on a buck on a snowy day.
Hey now, we're inside outdoors, baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Inside Outdoors is brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills, forests, and lakes of southern Indiana. Produced in Bloomington and brought to you live every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. Inside Outdoors features hosts Don Jordan, Buddy Bill Moser, and Rich Reardon, and gives you everything you need to know about the outdoors surrounding our local community, our state, and around our nation. With fishing, hunting, local and national outdoor news, the environment, natural resources, safety, issues in our community, and just down-home family fun, our goal is to inspire how to be a good steward of our precious natural resources. You can call into our show at 812-323-1200 and ask a question or tell us what's on your mind. So sit right back, get a cup of coffee, journey with us into the lakes and woods, and find out what our natural resources have to offer. If you miss the show, you can listen online at WFHB.org. Just go to the public affairs listing, and you'll find a podcast of our show at Inside Outdoors. This is WFHB Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
Good morning, everybody. It's Inside Outdoors. This is Saturday, if it's Saturday.
Yeah.
And I'm Don Jordan, and I'm here with my two buddies. I got Rich Reardon. Say hi, Rich.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. How about Alan Bronenberg? How you doing,
hi,
Alan?
Hi, guys. Good to see you.
Okay, so here we are. You're about to learn everything we know, which won't take long.
Well, one thing I know is that lake level is still a little bit above pool. It's 3 feet above at 541, and I still don't have a temperature. They haven't started doing that yet, but I'm guessing somewhere around 60 degrees. Been seeing a lot of people catching fish. One guy had like six or seven wipers. I don't know if you saw that on Facebook, but
Haven't seen that. No, but that's quite a few for wipers, you know.
He said it was his first time actually going for them, and he had like six big ones. So,
well, that explains it right there. First time,
yeah.
Was he in a boat or fishing from the bank?
He didn't say, or maybe I didn't read enough, but I've seen a lot of other people out there fishing. I went down to the spillway the other day. It doesn't look that high, but apparently it is.
Yeah, it's pretty high.
It is a little high, but and there were a fair amount of people fishing, so it's getting there. People are moving out and getting into the lake.
Well, I'm looking out the window right now, and the little fingerlet that sticks out on the north side of Fairfax Beach, those trees are still at least a couple feet underwater.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty high.
It is. That ought to be some pretty good fishing, because the leaves are starting to blossom out over there. And I would think, you know, that'd be an excellent fishing opportunity right there at that little place.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, you know, it all depends. You know, sometimes that flooded territory is good. Sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
So you just got to go try it. If there's a brush, you know, I'd cast some little beetle spins or just jigs up in there.
Right.
Maybe tipped with a bee moss. See what you can catch.
Yeah.
And crappies have been biting at Cataract, I know. And there's some little better crappies over there. Of course, you got to drive a little farther than Monroe.
Yeah.
And Cataract is still high, of course, but the crappies there don't seem to care.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can find a place to fish, actually there's lots of places to fish in there. All you have to do is find a creek channel and look for stumps, and
yeah,
there'll be crappies there. Probably the I don't know, Brookville may be as good as Cataract. Maybe Hardin Lake. You know where that one is?
Yeah.
Used to be Raccoon Lake.
Raccoon, yeah.
That's got good crappies in it, and I don't know, maybe even Lake Lemon. I hear so little about Lake Lemon anymore, but I know it's got bass in it at least, and some.
Yeah, because they have tournaments there.
Some pretty good bass, and yeah. I know it has crappies, and it also has carp. If you're interested, you know, carp have turned into a fly fishing species nowadays. I don't know.
Get out of here, really?
Yes, they readily take. Tiny little flies, you know, tiny little things, number 14 size hook, you know.
And, oh my.
And of course, you know, they got real sensitive lips, as you might guess. And you put one of those in their lips, you got him, buddy, as long as you keep the line from breaking.
I'll be darned.
And a good place to fish for those is a creek coming in to Lake Lemon up there by Bean Blossom.
Yeah. You know?
And I understand that a lot of carp fishermen visit that spot from the bank.
Yeah.
So you want to catch something big, that's the one.
I still have my granddad's carp spear up in the top of the barn. Well, 20 feet long, and it's got four little prongs on it. They're still pretty sharp. Grandpa always kept corks on the end of them to keep them sharp. So I still got it up there, but... I haven't used it any time lately.
Those corks will keep you from stabbing yourself too.
That's probably why he did it. Yeah, to
they're
keep
pretty
me
handy.
Myself.
Yeah, gigging carp. That's we used to bow hunt them until it got to the point where I just, you know, this pretty much needless slaughter of fish that you don't want.
Yeah,
just seemed somehow not ethical.
Yeah.
To me, you know, do as you please. It's legal.
You know, a lot of people used to catch them and grind them up, put them on their gardens.
Yeah.
I've seen that done before.
Well, in Florida, they make gar balls, fish balls out of gar. So I suppose you could do the same thing with carp.
Oh, my.
You know, you grind them up, bones and all, and make little balls of them, deep fry them.
There you go.
They're not bad. Need a little seasoning.
I would think.
But they're not that bad, actually. They're pretty good.
Well, I haven't seen a gar in a long time.
Well, you're in the wrong place.
That's for sure.
You're not going to find too many of those around Lake Monroe.
No.
You can sure see plenty of them in the rivers, and maybe not in White River. I very seldom hear of a gar coming out of White River.
Yeah.
But they're around and they make a good fish to catch, except you got to fish for them with you can't hardly hook them because they're rough, real hard mouth. And boys down in Florida, they cut a little strip of pantyhose, you know, about 2 or 3 inches long, put the hook in front of that and just drag it through the water. They may hit the hook, but that doesn't hook them. The pantyhose gets tangled in their teeth.
I'll be darned.
In their teeth.
Far out.
Yeah, isn't that something?
I was
amazed when I saw that first time. Amazed.
Well, it's amazing all the way different way people fish. I went down to visit my grandparents, found they moved down to, after they moved to Florida, Grandpa would go to the phosphate pits and net fish. What was he used to catch? Nile perch, maybe. I can't remember.
I'd say maybe tilapia or what's that other bowfins.
You know, okay,
a lot of bowfins. And you talk about a nice catch, you know, fun, something that's fun to catch. A bowfin is really great, and they're a lot like these snakeheads,
yeah,
you know, that have been put down so much. Do you know who Blair Chocolate is?
Blair Chocolate, no.
He's a fly fisherman, specializes in fishing for muskies.
Oh, wow.
Big muskies. And he ties these enormous flies and knows where they're at. He lives in the Carolinas someplace. But he had an article in the most recent, I think it was Trout Magazine. No, it was fly fishing, about fishing for snakeheads. Man, he's arguing that snakeheads where they've been established have not made the other fish disappear. And in fact, there hasn't been much change. They hang out in different kinds of places, and you know, they're ambush predators just like a muskie, and they get pretty big, you know.
Right.
You can get a 40 incher, and they fight real good. So, you know, that might be something to think about next time you go south to go fishing.
Yeah. Well, I used to, you know, and I used to love the way the Canadians and the Michiganders and the Muskellonge, you know, I mean, they really put the accent on those last syllables of the fish name. But there were some enormous fish back when I was a little kid. I mean, you know, it was nothing to see a 4 or 5 foot muskie at the bottom of some dam area or something. They're just huge fish.
Well, the world record 72 inches.
And, is it? Okay.
That came out of northern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And that was a big fish. That is stuffed at one of the lodges up there, you know, taxidermy.
Yeah.
And it's not that these fish are so long, but the big ones get thick, you know.
Yeah.
They're big in the belly.
Yeah.
And my experience has been that those big ones don't fight so well. You know, they definitely do not jump like the smaller
right.
muskies do, but they'll roll, you know, and of course that's...
Well, and the weight, I mean, just pulling them out of the water, I mean, that's... They just look, you know, really heavy.
I caught one 52 incher once, biggest one I ever caught, and was by myself and had to beach it because there was no way I could handle the fish in a net at the same time. So I pulled the boat up to the shore and jumped in the water and hauled him up on the shore.
Oh my gosh.
I got slime. You know how slimy they are when they get cut.
Oh, yeah.
Just drip this stuff, and of course you get it all over yourself. You know, I got slime, but I caught a big muskie anyway.
Yeah,
you don't care, you know.
You don't care. Almost all those bait shops up there, Michigan, Wisconsin, Lower Canada, all got just photographs all over the place of people catching huge muskies and pike, and you know, really big fish that I just don't see anything like that anymore.
Well, there's still a few of those 50 inchers around, and maybe some bigger. But here's the thing: to catch those big boys, you got to really get out there in October and troll with a sucker.
Sure.
And troll fairly deep, you know, and you rig the sucker so that it slowly rotates as it gets trolled through the water. And you rig the sucker up with hooks all the way from its front of its head all the way down to its butthole.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a long, cold process if you're looking for biggins.
I was going to say.
If you just want to go out and catch muskies, you can catch all kinds of muskies. There may not be too many keepers in there, but
yeah,
plenty of action. And that's what you're looking for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sitting all day waiting for one big muskie isn't my idea of fishing.
Well, it's a hunting type fishing. You know, you're on the moon all the time. Yeah. Even if you don't catch any fish, at least maybe you'll see one or get a couple of hits. You know, get a lot of follows with muskies in it.
So yeah.
You watch in the water. That's where you see your big ones following, but not hitting.
The problem on days like that is I usually run out of pork rinds and bologna sandwiches before I catch anything, and that's a bad day.
Yeah, well, that's okay. You know, in 1988, I fished every day during the muskie season.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that was some like 156 days, something like that, in a row. And I caught well over 100 muskies, 128, I believe.
Oh, my gosh.
That year, but only two keepers.
Yeah, is that right?
Right, only two keepers. That's 34 inches. So two over 34. You know, one of them was that 52 incher though.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not complaining.
Yeah, that made the day.
Lots of action and lots of top water strikes. You know, they're great top water hitters.
Huh.
I used a black popper, hula popper.
Hula popper.
Hula popper from
wow.
What's the name of that blur company? One over in Ohio. But anyway.
Yeah, I used to love Official Grandpa's hula poppers.
Yeah, it's a good lure still, you know.
Is it?
Oh yeah, and you fish those at night for top species. You know, if you got a good pond with some bass in it,
yeah,
you can have a lot of fun with a hula popper.
Oh man.
And get out there about dusk, you know.
Yep.
Fish the first 2 hours of darkness. Wow, kabam, bam! You can't see. You maybe can't see the hit, but you can hear them.
Oh, and, yeah, and feel it.
Yeah, if you catch one, that's for sure.
I'll bet I've still got some hula poppers out there in Grandpa's old fishing kit.
That's the Arbogast Lure Company.
Arbogast, yep.
Yeah, Arbogast Lure Company.
Yep.
They also make the Jitterbug.
Yep.
Which was one of the all-time big bass baits back when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
But not so much anymore.
Yeah.
We got plastic baits that you can't tell from.
Can you see mine here?
No.
I see it. You got a hula. You got a jitterbug.
There you go.
A frog jitterbug.
Yeah.
That's an old one. That one's probably 50 years old.
Yeah.
Well, you know. Keep it.
Yeah, I won't use that one. That was my grandpa's.
Yeah. It's in good shape, by the way. Once they've been attacked by a muscalonge numerous times, they get holes in them and scratches and bite marks.
Holes and scrapes, yeah.
Yeah, they get beat up pretty bad. Oh, well, muskies. What about mushrooms? What do you guys hear about shrooms?
I haven't seen one. Our normal spot that normally by now has been very productive. I haven't seen a one, and it's funny because so many of the plants that normally come up after the mushrooms are already up. We got very few May apples up, which is surprising since they usually come up before the plants that are up now. Weird year.
Well, I noticed coming back from Indianapolis today, up at IU Woods. What's it? Up there by Martinsville.
Oh yeah.
Martinsville. I can't remember. Belzer? Not Belzer.
No.
Anyway.
Up there by the Morgan Monroe.
No. No, it's that private outfit. It's where the IU sends the troubled kids and whatnot to have summer camp.
I know what you're talking about. I can't remember the name of it though.
Well, in any case, the hillsides there along the road were covered with new May apples just up.
Yep.
Just up. So my buddies say that April the 24th is the day to start looking for yellow mushrooms. Now, yeah. I haven't seen anything but blacks, pictures of blacks, and people saying they found a few blacks. I haven't seen any big hauls yet.
What we usually get is the black ones. They're usually right. Early, and you know, we see a bunch of them, and then there's never any yellow ones though in that same spot afterwards.
No, they don't seem to grow in the same places.
No.
But the black ones will come back in exactly the same place every year.
Every time.
That's right. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, every year that we've been here, we've seen them. And you know, when we built the house here, the old fella up at used to live up front of the road. They're gone now, but he says it was one spring after we'd been here a couple of years, and he says, you find any mushrooms back there? And I said, I haven't had any time to look. And he says, mind if I go back and look? And I'm like, no, go ahead. And he came back with a whole bunch of them and showed me. And I said, oh my God, where'd you find those? He says, well, we found those in the back, not where we usually do. And I said, where do you usually find them? He goes, right where you built the house. Well, yeah. You know, you might have said something. I can move the house over.
Built a house on his mushroom bed.
Yeah.
Oh man, you're cruel.
Yeah.
That's
I was brokenhearted.
Yeah, geez. Well, you know, you can buy spores and kits to grow them now. Did you know that?
I've seen that, and I just don't know how successful that is.
Well, you know, I've tried other kinds of mushrooms. It works.
They do, yeah.
It definitely works, and I'd say it might be worth a try. Once you get them established, you remember those big old galvanized wash tubs that you used to wash in when you were a baby or your little kid, if you lived in the country?
I got a couple of them out there in the barn now.
Well, you get that full of horse, and that'll grow mushrooms, buddy. And those morels will establish themselves in those wash tubs.
Yeah.
And if you bring them inside and keep them at the right kind of temperature, they will produce year after year.
Okay. So, I may have to give this a try.
It may be worth trying. I mean, two big wash tubs, you can get quite a few morels.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I'm tired. I can't really walk through the woods and up and down these hills like I used to. So I'm thinking about trying it.
Well, you know, we've not found any down into the sides of the hills and the ravines. Usually ours are on, I think it's probably because the ravines here close to the lake are all just,
vertical.
They're vertical and they're clay.
They don't hold moisture.
No.
You notice that most of the big mushroom finds come from areas that are relatively flat.
Yeah.
And that's because the water has time to soak in.
Just to soak down. Uh-huh. And you know, a lot of them, the old woods where if you find a woods where cattle used to run through, that still have some poplar and maple and cherry trees in it, and some elms, that's about as good as you're going to get around here.
Speaking of the subject of trees and mushrooms, the best one of all is elm tree, right?
Yeah.
You have to do is find where an elm tree used to be.
Yep. Elm stumps, the best.
Elm stump, dead elm tree, where an elm log laid.
Yep.
You know, there's something in that. I can't believe that nobody has investigated that and ran a chemical analysis of what's in that elm tree that makes these mushrooms go nuts. You know, I don't understand why nobody's come up with that. Maybe somebody knows, they're just keeping it secret.
Well, you'd think somebody might know something. I mean, it's just too consistent for there not to be some sort of relationship.
Absolutely. And you mentioned some other poplar trees. That's, you know, that's known to be attractor of morels. And where else have I found? Cherry trees, like you said.
If you find a little woods that's got poplar, cherry, and maples in them, you're probably going to find some mushrooms.
Well, one place I can tell you is not good is a beech tree. They seem to soak up all the water that's anywhere in their area.
They do. And, you know, beech trees seem to grow, Don, in really bad soil. I don't know why.
They do.
You know, most of the property around here where, you know, I got the worst, thinnest soil, there's beech trees all over them.
Yeah.
So they seem to grow where not a lot of things grow. You know, that's walnut trees, you know, the jug loan that the walnut trees put out does not seem to be conducive to the mushrooms either.
No, they've got a toxic something in them.
Yeah, jug loan.
Jug loan?
Yeah.
Hmm. And what does that do?
It's a phytotoxic compound that retards the growth of certain species of plants around it.
So that you say phyto, so it's the sun makes it grow, or
no phyto, a plant. Phyto, not photo, phyto. Yeah. It's a phytotoxic substance that it affects some plants and not others. Now, you know, you see a walnut tree, you typically don't see a lot of other trees in that little cluster, and it can go out for quite a ways, away from itself, you know, like 100 feet. So we didn't realize it when we planted the orchard and some of the apple trees, the two that are closest to the walnut trees are dead. They never produce anything and they're dead. So
that's just incredible. And, you know, we've been talking about lately and seeing articles about mama trees helping out their baby trees that grow all around them, you know.
Right.
And now we got, well, I've kind of known this for a long time, actually, about the black walnut. And these trees inhibit other trees. And maybe they inhibit, maybe their offspring, their baby trees, don't have the same reaction. They can tolerate that.
Exactly so.
So they can, they are eliminating, they're helping their babies by eliminating the competition.
Yep. Uh-huh. And you know what? Another plant that actually, and I learned this the hard way, another plant that has that similar substance and effect on everything around it is sunflowers.
Really?
One year I got it in my head I was going to take a 2-acre field and plant some sunflowers in it, a field of sunflowers, and I did, and God, they looked great for a little while. And of course the birds came in and just, you know, shredded them before I got them. And then the next spring I noticed that it was all just bare dirt. There wasn't even grass growing there. And sure enough, sunflower seeds have got jug glown in it as well.
Is that right?
And it was probably 3 years maybe before I got grass to grow there again. And hell, I went out and tilled it, and you know, to get the to get some air and some sunlight in there to kill that that compound. And man, it took 3 years before I ever got grass back there.
Could jug glown be responsible for the very specific and recognizable taste of a black walnut?
You know, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think that
they are unusual tasting, and I know if you eat too many of them, you'll get sick. I can tell you that
for sure. For sure.
You think that's the jug loan?
You know what, Don? I'll be honest. I just don't know. I just don't know. You know, with all the different oils and alkaloids coming out of the juice of a walnut, it could be a number of things, but who knows? It could very well be that.
Yeah, they're really loaded with stuff, aren't they?
They are, yeah. Just an enormous number of compounds, yeah.
And it's supposed to be really good for male health. I hear, and I don't know why, but
yeah, probably because most of those oils are good at reducing cholesterol.
Do they have selenium in them? Do you think?
I don't think so. No, I don't know why they would. Yeah.
No. In any case.
Yeah.
Shrooms. I wish we had our call-in show. We could get back in the studio at WFHB. Let us in.
We can get some reports.
Absolutely. I know there's people listening out there that would love to call in about this topic, and specifically about the mushrooms. And well, it's hard to do when you can't do it.
So very true.
Okay. COVID. So what else is that?
Speaking of COVID and what it's done for us in the last year and a half. Ted Nugent, I got a little news about him. This is the guy who spent the guy who spent the last year calling COVID-19 a scam and ridiculing mask wearers as sheep, and saying proudly announcing that he would never take a coronavirus vaccine. He's tested positive and he feels like he's dying and he can't crawl out of bed.
I'm sorry, Ted. Hey, we hope you get better.
Couldn't happen to any nicer people.
You'll make a good profit for our side once you
get,
especially if you die.
Yeah, I was going to say. make a real point for us here, Ted.
Yeah, and listeners who don't know who Ted Nugent is, well, he's a country western singer who is extreme to the right of Trump type of politics, and has been arrested for poaching several times, and was banned from hunting from the compact states, which is either 34 or 38 states he's banned from ever hunting again.
Yep.
Right.
And this is the fellow we're talking about. And he's a rock and roller, and he used to do, he did for the original show that Rich and Buddy Bill started out, he did their theme song, which was pretty good, actually.
Well, he didn't really do the theme song, but he was on the show once. And
oh, I thought he did a song.
No,
for
he
us.
Played he played some stuff down in his ranch in Texas for us over the phone. It's pretty funny. Okay. That was in the days before he came out as a too much of a hardcore person, and but he's really destroyed. You know, he was even involved with Blankenship, if you remember him from the Cole days, in their rallies that they had, you know, like Make America Great Again. But that was before that even. And they had Hannity and some other people. And that was before Blankenship went to jail for his role in murdering the 19 miners that died, which was about 10 years ago or so. So, you know, that's the story with those guys. They talk a lot, but they end up in jail or worse. So I don't know what to say. You know, and another thing I read that was kind of interesting was last week, hundreds of mostly white students at Ohio State, I guess this was spring break. I'm not sure exactly. Oh, it was a football game. They literally destroyed a street in Columbus. They flipped over 7 cars.
In
a block party after a foot.
What? Why did they do that?
Well, I mean, they were just having a good time, you know? I mean,
you say after a football game?
Now, if this was in a black neighborhood, I'm not sure it would have turned out this way, but the cops refused to show up, saying they'd come down when it was safe for them to come down there.
Well, there you go. Well,
that's a good approach, actually.
Yeah.
Did you hear this week, past week, there was a car chase in which the guy who was being chased killed himself, you know, ran into a tree.
Yeah.
Okay. The police in that, there were several mentions of it, saying that they were calling off the chase because of the speed of the car. So I think that was an eminently sensible idea and position on the part of the Bloomington police.
Yep.
You know, the guy got up to 105, said, "We're not chasing him anymore.
No.
We know who he is. Right. We'll get him. Next time, we'll find him."
You know, that's the way it used to be. You know, I remember when someone would rob a bank, get out, get ahead of somebody. They were last seen going 150 mile an hour, you know, down some highway somewhere. There was a 2-lane highway, and then they didn't know where he was. Nobody was going to go chasing after him at full speed. They eventually got him. I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, they had to get him that minute or they'd never get him again.
Right. I got speeding stories for you. Back in the day, in 1969, I owned a 1967 XKE 4.2. 4.2 with the 3 carburetors, you know.
Yeah.
Before the 12-cylinder, it was the fastest Jaguar. I was driving back from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to Indianapolis, and it was late at night. It was like 2 in the morning or something, and Interstate 24 had just opened, right? That's from Chattanooga all the way across the state, east to west. And through the mountains there, when you come out of Chattanooga, there's these big, sweeping, banked curves, you know? God, my car was just, it was wanting it, you know, it was wanting it. And so I let it have it, and lucky for me, this car, the faster it went, the more push down it came, you know, it had downforce, and it stuck like glue. And, you know, I had it, you know, as fast as it would go. And coming down the mountain and one of those big swerving cars, at the bottom of that, here's the Tennessee State Patrol car said,
"Oh no."
Okay. I went by him at 160 miles an hour. I was going downhill, you know. They would never do that on flatland, but downhill, 160 miles an hour. I said, what the hell? You know, I just left the foot on it. He never even moved. He never came out.
Of course not.
And there wasn't anybody on the radio waiting for me down at the end of the stretch. Oh. So thank you, Tennessee State Patrol, for that.
You were too much trouble, Don.
Oh, I know I was. How'd you like to chase me?
Not a chance. But you know, shortly after that period of time, you know, they started putting those runoffs with the gravel
and dirt
for the semis that got out of control and couldn't make the curve.
Yeah, right. Those I've remarked on those to my wife many times driving.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen a couple of trucks go up those.
I've seen one stuck in there before. I never saw him get there, but he was stuck fast. They just left her there till they got wreckers, I guess, because it was just sitting there in one of that thing. I'll tell you what, he was buried to the bumper.
Oh, there's no way you're meant to come out of those, weren't you?
Oh, no.
You know, you cannot come out.
No.
The one that I saw came by me. I saw it coming way back. You know, it was in that mountainous stretch. And he was hauling, you know, he was hauling. And he's coming down in the outside, you know, the passing lane.
Okay? Yeah.
So I got over as far as I could on the right. He must have been gone 90 when he went by me.
Oh, man.
The corner was up ahead, and there was the pullout. He just plowed right up that pullout. Just went
right. He did.
Then right, you know, dust and rocks and gravel flying, you know, I probably almost as bad as having a crash. It looked like it tore the truck up pretty bad.
Oh, it sure would. Yeah. And, but, you know, hitting that would snap your neck just like you hit something.
Oh, man. I hope he had his seatbelt on.
Yeah.
You know, because he was hauling.
So, you know, they put those there for a reason. You can imagine how many people actually went over side before they put those there. I mean,
yeah, right.
You know, they know exactly where to put them. So
they put them in the right places.
Yeah.
It's good to know what they're there for. First time I saw them, I thought, what the heck is that? And then next one, you see tire tracks going up.
Yep.
You know, oh.
Yeah, I get it now. Yeah, that's funny.
Speaking of interstate highways and bridges everywhere that they build nowadays, do you realize that they've shut off the most beautiful views of America from the highway that exist are on the highways? You know, you can see up and down the river. Not anymore. The walls that they're building on these, all the new bridges, cannot be seen over, even in my pickup truck. Only a 18-wheeler can see over the bridges and see these views now when you go across.
Why are they doing that?
I would assume it's a safety move of some kind and a misplaced one. Because now, places I used to love to look at, I can't see anymore.
I'll be darned.
We did notice coming across the, what bridge was it today? It might have been the one in Martinsville. I think it's just got railings on top so you can still see the White River there.
Yeah.
Which is down, by the way. Is down quite a bit, and the big sandbanks and gravel banks are showing.
Yeah.
There were 39 goes across Martinsville from 37 to 69.
Oh, you're talking about 39 that goes through the city over to 67, yeah.
Yeah, the cut across there.
Yeah.
That bridge there. That one.
Yeah.
There's a big bend in the river there, and there's big gravel bars, and they're all showing right now. So things are looking pretty good if you're a river fisherman.
You know, yeah.
Starting to drop down. Those are places right in there where there's some big catfish caught.
I've always seen guys fishing off of those bars in the side of the road there.
Right. It's a good spot.
Yeah.
Big catfish. Well, what about turkey hunting, Rich?
I'll have to look that up.
I know it's either started. Let's see. I think.
Isn't it the 24th or 28th? Or
it's coming right up. The youth hunt, I think, is this weekend. Or was this past weekend. But yeah, it's probably next weekend. It is, I would say.
I think so.
For the main turkey hunt. And, you know, I haven't seen many turkeys. How about you?
I was going to say, it must be close to season because I haven't seen them once.
No, I haven't.
As opposed to like every other week of the year, I see them all over the place.
I got an answer for you. It is youth started on April 17th, was April 17th and 18th, right. So that's over. Spring starts on tomorrow. Well,
today.
I want to say tomorrow, but April 21st. So it started now if we're broadcasting this on Saturday. And that runs till May 9th.
There you go.
So right. we got 2 weeks or so, 3 weeks starting this weekend.
So it starts started on Thursday. Is that right?
Yes. Thursday. And it starts Wednesday. What is today? The 20th, the 21st. So it starts Wednesday.
Yeah.
And it'll go till May 9th, which will be a, let me see, May 9th is a Sunday. So a couple, 3 weeks. And you can take one bearded male turkey per hunter in youth or spring season, and one bird of either sex per hunter in the fall, which starts, might as well tell you that too, that starts on October 1st.
Okay.
So we got the season is open from now until May 9th.
Yes.
Okay. Well, this will be the first big weekend for the turkey hunters. Although
right.
It's more of a solitary kind of hunt, and you don't usually see groups of turkey hunters hanging around like you do deer hunters. You know,
no.
Turkey hunters are definitely a more solitary bunch, and a lot of bow hunters for turkey. So it does require some skill and some know-how. And
I would think so.
Just keep your safety in mind. Remember that turkeys have red on them. They have white on them. They have brown and golden colors. And if you're going into the woods, don't wear something with an American flag patch on your shoulder. And don't wear any red bandana around your neck.
Right.
And don't wear any white gloves. they might mistake you for a deer.
As stylish as they may be.
Yeah, right. But I remember very well several years ago now, a woman in Connecticut who was out working in her garden, which her house was on the edge of the woods, wearing white gardening gloves.
Oh my God.
Was shot and killed by a deer hunter.
Oh my God.
Mistaking her for a deer. So you don't have to worry about that maybe so much, but don't wear those red bandanas for sure. And don't act like a turkey.
Well, I've seen, where I was seeing them over there on the dam road, high above that ravine that goes behind the spillway there and the tailwaters. I saw those every day like clockwork when I'd go into town. I haven't seen them in at least a month. And there's usually one or two that cross my gate up in the afternoon. And I haven't seen him in quite some time. Usually about the time I go get the mail, I'd see him somewhere close to the gate up there. And I haven't seen any of those for at least a month.
Wow. Well, I haven't seen any, period, for a while. And they used to attack me driving down the road in my truck. They trapped they'd attack my truck like they wanted to claw me,
Yep.
And it's that time of year for them to act like that, I think they're out there entertaining the ladies now.
Yeah.
And, one year, Steve Bax, the grouse biologist, turkey biologist down in Mitchell, took me down on a turkey watching session in Lawrence County. And he knew right where every turkey in the county was. And
sure he did.
We pulled up next to this big bean field, mowed bean field, and here was all these turkeys out there. And I want to tell you, these guys, they look like big remote control vacuum cleaners. Just kind of strutting around for each other. And then one guy, see if he can put it better. And all the hens, you know, the females are back along the wood line watching them. You know, there's about 15 of them over there watching these three or four males out there doing daring do. And you see this one young male who got eliminated from the strutting competition.
Yeah.
Over there amongst them.
Yeah.
And I guess you can probably figure out what he was doing.
Yeah.
And there's an official name for that in biology now. It's called the sneaky, you know. That's an official biological term now.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, and there's, you know, there's an old joke, you know, that I won't repeat on here, but everybody's heard it. The old bull and the young bull, you know, you've heard that one before.
Both of them.
Yeah. That's what that reminds me of, Don.
Yeah. There you go. Well, turkey hunters, you know, what do turkey hunters don't have a bar to go to or anything like that? There isn't, you know, any little country bar where you're camouflaged. Well, of course, you're camouflaged.
I wonder if that's, you know, that may be true. Because up in Michigan, I mean, you know, up on the whole west side of the state there, you know, you can buy carrots by the bushel. You can buy corn by the 50-pound bag. You know, you can get your piano tuned, and you can go into a bar there where if you're not in camo, you know, you're probably not going to stay there very long. The whole west side of Michigan's like that. You know, deer feeding stand, bait station, you know, all the gas stations along there sell, you know, carrots and corn.
You mean
we don't have anything like that here.
No, well, we don't have, it's not part of our culture. See, we didn't have really any hunting here until the 60s.
Right.
No deer hunting anyway.
Yeah.
And it's not ingrained. Up in Wisconsin, when deer season opens, everybody who runs a business expects their employees not to be there that day.
I was going to say.
You know, because they're not going to be there.
Yeah.
And sometimes whole families. I mean, it's just, it's kind of mind-boggling for somebody from down here or someplace like this, you know, all across the country, to go up into that country. That'd be, you know, specifically northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. But it's the same way in the Dakotas, you know, and Missouri and other places.
That's fascinating.
That just go all out for deer hunting season.
Yeah. I had flown into, there was a meeting up near Crystal Mountain, up in Michigan, north of Michigan there. And me not knowing anything about geography, I flew into Grand Rapids and was just going to get a rental car and drive up. And that's a little bit further than I thought it would be, but what a fun drive. It was a very educational drive to go from Grand Rapids up to Traverse City, Crystal Mountain up that way. It is because that's, you know, Cadillac, Kalkaska around here. That's where we used to go mushroom hunting. When I was a kid, too, you know.
They still got them, too.
Oh, sure.
They got lots of guides up there now that have staked out places that you don't want to trespass on. And it's not like it used to be.
No.
But, you know, what do you pay a guide? You pay a guide $100 probably.
Yeah.
To take you out and get, you know, 5-10 pounds of mushrooms. That's probably worth it. I might do it.
I was going to say, you know, they're going for $50 to $80 a pound at the markets when you can find them. Of course, by the time you get them, they're probably at least a week old. So, yeah, you know,
right.
Getting a guide for $100 for, you know, I mean, up in that area, if you pay somebody $100, you're probably going to end up with a bushel full of mushrooms.
Well, I would hope so. I would hope
so.
I've seen truck fulls of them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the seats, the whole cabin filled with mushroom, the beds filled with mushroom.
It's truth.
Beyond belief.
Well, we got pictures of me. I was around 14 years old, and I went with my grandparents, and we'd come home with They had a station wagon. We would have like 600-800 pound onion sacks full of them, along with anything else they could put them in, like bushel baskets, those wash tubs you mentioned. You know, we had one of those.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
oh,
just,
that'd be nice. That'd
yeah,
be nice.
I mean, and my grandmother would cut them up.
Where was this?
This was when I was 14, 15, 16 years old, up in middle of Michigan. We lived up in Anderson, Indiana at the time. And we'd come back, and my grandmother would spend a week, freezing them so that we could have them all year long. And we did. I mean, you know, when I was that age, you know, instead of having potatoes, we'd have mushrooms because we had them. I mean, it was a different deal. You know, I can't imagine that now.
I'm going to slobber and salivate if you keep talking about
that. Oh, my God. I just, you know, and she had figured out over the years of doing this often enough that just freezing the mushrooms, and she tried it a half a dozen different ways. The best way to do them was to half fry them, them not quite all the way, and then put them in the freezer in water, and they would hold together much better than she just, you know, did them raw. They tried drying them. They'd tried freezing them whole. They tried, you know, freezing them in water, freezing them bare, just in air. And she found that the best way to do it was to halfway fry them and put them in water, put them in milk cartons. She saved half gallon milk cartons for years. And, you know, she would like put them in there and put cellophane over the top of them, and fill them up with mushrooms and fill it up with water, put the cellophane on the top, and then just pack those into a freezer. And all year long, you know, she'd pull them out, defrost them, de-thaw them, and, you know, we'd have mushrooms all year long that way. And you know, you knew it was getting about time when it got to be, Valentine's Day, you were about out of mushrooms for the year, and you know, you knew it was time to go again pretty soon because you were out of mushrooms.
Yeah. Well, that's a good story. And why don't we all three go up to Central Michigan and find Grandma's house?
Yeah.
And go get us a bunch of shrooms.
Well, let me tell you how that works. So we had some friends, my grandparents had some friends in Sturgis, Michigan. And these people were outdoorsmen, you know, extraordinary. They'd go fishing, deer hunting, with my grandparents all over the country. And they knew a bunch of farmers who had, you know, 800 acres here, 400 acres here. This old fella knew them. They knew them, and they were very respectful, and these people knew it, and they'd let them come onto the property whenever they wanted. And when they did that, my grandparents would make three trips a year. They'd go in the spring once for the black ones, and then they'd go once again about a month later for the yellow ones, and they'd go for the beef hearts in the fall. And my grandparents did that every year for decades, you know, as long as I was alive and they were able. They did that. It's a wonderful time.
So you were your formative years, you were eating morels on a regular basis,
probably 6 months of the year at least, and I didn't think there was anything unusual about that.
And see, look how good things turned out for you. You know,
exactly. So see, I've been saying this.
I just read something that there's a poisonous mushroom that looks a little like a morel.
Oh yeah,
but false if you morel. Cut it. If you cut it in half, the stem goes all the way up inside the mushroom where it doesn't with the morel.
Yeah.
So that's a way to find out if you're unsure.
They do look very much like a black morel.
Yeah.
They really do.
Yeah.
So be
and you know what's
there.
Interesting is they're you know, everyone listening to this probably should consider them to be poisonous. In fact, there are people who are somewhat immune to those mushrooms, and I know people who regularly eat them have no problem, and I know people who have nearly died by eating them. So it's not anything you want to
it's a roll of the dice.
Exactly. You don't want to roll the dice on that one, but you can be fooled. They if you're not an expert at mushrooms, you might end up eating one if you're not careful.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I hear Rich is getting nervous over there about...
Well, I'm just giving you guys the high sign. We're down to 3 minutes. And I did want to mention one more thing that since we were talking about safety a little bit that we didn't talk about, but now is the time for people to start mowing their lawns. And it's something we mention once in a while, but don't take your kids inside when someone's mowing. If there's something that's been dropped in the lawn that, you know, got hidden out there in the tall grass, it can come flying at 200 miles an hour. And I saw a picture of somebody who mentioned this where they had a wrench that was embedded in their front door. So you certainly don't want your kids running around while you're mowing at the very least, or really anybody near you, because it can happen that a rock will come out or something. So I just want to throw that out there since everybody's starting to mow their lawns now.
It'll come out like a bullet.
Number two announcement, the birds are back for the most part. I mean, I haven't seen any warblers, which is odd, but we've got some got new guys coming in. I got the thrashers here.
Right.
Some others, but we had no Phoebe this year, and which is really unusual.
And somebody saw a hummingbird.
Well, hummingbirds, they should be back by now.
Yeah, we don't have any here, but I've known people just recently have said they found some.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the birds are back. They don't have any water. So since we haven't had any rain, make sure you put some water in your bird bath or get some water out for them and something, because that's a crucial ingredient, and they're building nests now. The bluebirds are scouting and have started building.
Yep.
I see them going in and out of the birdhouse. So,
well, and Alan and I were just talking about, I guess you saw a cicada coming out of the hole or something.
But, that's gonna... three holes out by the barn, on the path to the barn. The birds must have got them right away because I didn't see any of them, but they most clearly were cicada holes. They're coming, guys. Any day.
Very soon. Yeah.
Any day.
Well, that's great. I want to see Buddy Bill eat a pound.
And yep. my comment was, we'll hopefully have some fat, healthy birds by the end of this whole thing, because they're going to have a feast real soon.
They will have a feast.
Yeah. Okay, boys. Well, is it time to go now?
Yes, it is. The music just started, and I want to thank everybody for coming and joining us. We hopefully will be in the studio sometime fairly soon. One thing I like about the Zoom is it's easier to invite a guest, so we may have some taped segments or something, but that's certainly been a interesting year, and we're hoping to be back in the studio where you can call in sometime very soon. But with that...
Yes. I hope so too.
We're going to have to take off. So thanks, guys, for being here. And we'll see you all next week, I guess. Hopefully, if the sun keeps rising.
Have a great week, guys.
Arrivederci.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody. Well, that's all we have time for today. Inside Outdoors comes to you from the beautiful rolling hills and green forests of southern Indiana. Thanks for listening. Inside Outdoors is brought to you each week on Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. If you happen to miss the show, you can listen online at wfhb.org. Just go to the public affairs listing and you'll find a podcast of our show.